cliffcentral.com.
Let's bring in our celebrity guests for this morning. Two gentlemen that I think are extraordinary. And, you know, we've got a lot of talent in this country. But when it comes to comedy, we have just the most incredible supply. And I'm only talking about the Goliath family of just extraordinary talent from that family. And let me start off by telling you a little bit of background about Nicholas. He is doing amazing things, taking the world by storm, the youngest member of the Goliath team, like the other members of that family. Nicholas is also, and remember, they're not all actually related. Remember, that's the important thing. We found that out last time. He's a multi-talented individual. He's an amazing salesperson, MC, announcer, entertainer. He's performed at Parker's Comedy, State Theatre, Joburg, the Market Theatre, Carnival City, Emperor's Palace, Captain's Comedy, and various other club shows.
Mm.
He's a qualified MC. He's hosted many sales conferences for Vodacom and FNB, among others, and has done... You like doing those corporate things, dude? That's hard work, man. That's let me switch on your microphone. God, I'm so professional.
Yeah, look at you.
Isn't it great?
Making us look
what professional guy in the world.
Yeah, what do we do on the show?
Yeah. Sorry, you were saying?
Am I live?
Okay. Yeah.
Hello.
Hey, how are you? Nice to see you, bro.
Thank you so much for having me, man. I left home at 6 o'clock this morning because I don't know what traffic to Sandton's like, just so
Where
you know.
Where do you live?
On the West Rand, Florida. Oh. And then it took me 15 minutes to get here. So I've been chilling. But thank you.
I've heard about the West Rand.
It's dodgy.
I've heard... There are a lot of inbreeders on
but
the
that's
West Rand.
Far west. I'm like near west. Yeah, that's okay. Definitely.
You got to be careful. Like if you go too far west, you know, once you go past Silver Star Casino, shit gets really not like,
dodgy.
Like people chain their kids to the front gate and the dog goes with them to the shops. It's that kind of situation. Is that true?
I wish you were joking about that, but it's so
it's true.
I've seen kids chained to the gates in Krugersdorp.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a huge there's an oversupply of like organs on the black market there,
also on the white market
too.
Sometimes in the colored market, find one or two, but those are cheap.
Those are rare. They're quite expensive. Yeah. Colored market organs.
Yeah, and they come
so
with
West Rand. Okay, so you were worried about traffic this morning, so you hit the road from the West Rand at 6.
Well, it was more like 6:15.
Do you ever wake up that early normally?
Not a chance. It's well, I do. I've got a kid that I have to take to school, so yeah. He had to hike to school this morning, but it's cool because I'm here.
On the West Rand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, you had a kid.
I might have a new dog when I get home, though.
Silver lining.
All right, we'll talk about all these other these corporate gigs and the rest in a minute, but I want to talk to Hannes as well. Hannes is he's a regular contributor to the Casper radio show. And are you on today, by the way?
No, unfortunately not.
He's
because Leo Sayers here.
Can I tell you something? He's actually quite abusive, Casper. He has you on and then he just doesn't. And then he has you on again. And it's almost like you're a peasant and you're like, oh, please, Your Majesty, won't you have me on? And he's like, this week, yeah. Next week, fuck you. You know? Yeah. He's like that. He's
yeah, and when he has me on, it's always, you know, he cracks the whip and I have to be funny at the drop of a hat.
And he wants you
things.
To, like, come up with impromptu scripts and all kinds of things. He's a monster. But, Hannes, we've met you before a couple of times. I don't think you've ever been on my show with me.
No. It's a huge pleasure to be here.
Hannes has been in demand for many years as a comedic actor, writer, voiceover artist. He's appeared in a variety of theatre, television, and film productions, including several farces, Afrikaans comedy plays, since 2001. But I like this because you say you're a writer creator, and those are actually way more interesting terms to me than performer or comedian, right?
I suppose,
and it's harder.
Yes, I think the two feed each other.
Sure.
I started out as a performer, and then you get an opportunity to write or create something, and then the one kind of feeds. Ideally, I'd like to kind of write and create stuff, and then perform in them as well.
And you work with old Melt Sieberhagen, huh?
Yes, quite regularly.
Yeah.
We kind of started doing comedy we studied together at UP Drama, and then started our waitering careers together. And then we subsequently started doing comedy, and then we've got like a double act, the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Do you serve food and tell jokes at the same time?
If you have to.
Okay.
Now listen. There is so much material in this country, but I'm kind of, I don't know about you guys if you feel the same way. I'm so over politics. I'm actually sick of it.
Mm.
I thought about it. I was talking to a friend of mine over the long weekend, last weekend, And I think she said to me, oh, what do you think of Jay? And I said, whoa. I actually don't want to talk about politics right now. I don't want to talk about the cabinet reshuffle or Brian Molefe or... and I have to do it on the show. It's part of what we do here. We, you know, had Justice Malala in here yesterday, and he's terrific. But I don't know if you're feeling the same way. Like, I'm just hot full of these politicians.
I'm done. But yeah. But you see, also my problem is, to be very honest, is I don't understand politics enough to get involved. So, like, I do no political humor on stage, simply because my feeling is just like, it doesn't matter how much we talk about what we do. Like, I feel like we're not making the change. We're not going to make the change. It's politics is going to happen either way. Then I'm just like, it comes back to, you know, your perspective on life. If you're looking for the negatives, or you see the negatives in everything, that's all you're going to see.
Correct.
Then with politics, there's so much negativity from my perspective. I'm just like, I don't need all of this in my life. I've got enough stress. My life is carrying on no matter what's happening with politics. I still got to pay my bills. So then I'm just like, I have no time for politics.
I also think that politics has become so overrun by personal opinion. So we don't just see the news as it is, objectively. It's always subjective, and everybody's got an ill-informed opinion because people don't read the whole article. You know,
they read the 140 characters on Twitter, and they think they're an expert.
Yeah. So it becomes a little...
All right. I do want to know what you think of this painting of Jacob Zuma and Nelson Mandela. And it's everybody was talking about it yesterday. I only saw it at like 10 o'clock last night. What do you think of it, boys? What do we make of this?
Well, what I saw yesterday is, I mean, everybody's major concern is kind of how explicit it is that it's not like you, as an art critic, you're looking and you go, I wonder what the artist was thinking. We're pretty clear on what he was thinking. It's, you know, it's anal penetration of legacies and stuff like that. I find myself just going, who's going to buy it? I can't see it hanging in the LARPA next to the 95 drop goal framed picture. You know, as Oma Konkair, we cover it with a handuki, you know. That's the
actually
thing.
You have to ask, because someone will buy this. There's going to be somebody, but where would you put
where
a painting
would you put
like
it,
that?
Yeah.
I wouldn't even put it in a dungeon.
It's got to go in your bedroom. Like, I feel like that's
you feel like
I personally wouldn't put it in my bedroom. Yeah. I wouldn't even put it in my bathroom. But I'm just like, if you're the person that buys it, surely that's your thing. And those are the things you want to do in the bedroom.
I'll put it on the roof of the bedroom, but surrounded by mirrors.
I've got a painting. You know that guy, Picasso, who comes for Sexpo every year and he paints with his penis?
I said that he has to have colored children.
So
started the Rainbow Nation. That guy.
I don't want to see his blue period.
So I've got a picture that he painted of me, and it's here. It's in the storeroom. I don't want to put that up anywhere. That is not a quarter as embarrassing as the Nelson Mandela and Jacob Zuma picture that Ayanda Mabulu just painted. So I don't know that even if I were a collector and I thought, oh, well, this is one of the most controversial pieces ever made, and it really is, and it'll be worth millions one day, maybe, who knows? I still wouldn't want to put it anywhere. I'd hide it in, I'd wrap it in about 10 layers of stuff and put it in a safe somewhere, and one day, if it's worth something, sell it to an idiot.
I have some curiosity as to, of the last three of his really controversial paintings, which one is going to end up being the most controversial or the most valuable at the end of the day.
And you know what I love is the hypocrisy. Like, there are going to be a whole bunch of people who have a major problem with this one, but they didn't have such a problem when it was just Jacob Zuma or the Guptas, and they didn't have such a problem when it was Helen Ziller on that cart that Musi was pulling with his enormous cock, and she had a like legs spread and everything else. Do you remember that one? That horrible one Kenny Kunena had made.
What? Kenny Kunena's behind that painting.
Don't you remember? He commissioned it. He wanted
it. I wonder where he hung it.
He's probably got that in his bedroom.
I feel like Kenny drives around and just smiles. Looks at the painting next to him all the time. Just like,
He's got like 10 pictures of it on his phone.
I think these paintings all end up in Krugersdorp, probably.
Yeah, like Tretyakov's.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Now, speaking of Krugersdorp, because that is where you're from, the West Rand.
Yes.
I'm actually originally from the West Rand.
Are you really?
Yes, I'm from the Red Rand.
So what have you seen there? Because, again, I've never been, and I hear stories. Be honest now. What have you heard from the West Rand?
Well,
come, let us know. Is it like the hills have eyes?
Well, mag tires are commodities.
Yes. Yeah, that's the biggest trading currency, right?
Depending, Krugersdorp is rough. Like, because I was in, I would still say I'm in Ridderpoort rather than Krugersdorp. Yeah, yeah. But I was like right on the edge of it. Yeah. The hills have eyes. Yeah.
Look, I also haven't ventured deep into Krugersdorp for obvious reasons.
For obvious reasons.
Because they're actually, like, there are a lot of racists there. There are a few left.
Sure. I mean, years ago, there was
a lot. Not a few. There's many, many.
I just know we're going to get messages from people in Krugersdorp like,
I have a friend who is colored, married to a white man, and they were attacked. You see?
Really?
I never go to Kruger's. I actually don't mind Kruger's.
Who attacked them? Was it a man or a woman?
It was a group of men.
Oh, my God.
It could have
God.
Been a kid in a Slipknot mask as well.
In a pub.
Yeah. Now, wasn't
years ago, there was that story, and everybody was blame
the kid with the sword.
Blame Slipknot, blame Slipknot. And I was like, blame Krugersdorp.
What a horrible place. Really, Mub, someone was attacked just for having a colored wife and a white husband.
Mm.
Unbelievable. Yes, wow. It's this country. We've got such issues, huh? We've got so many things that we just need to resolve. If there was a shrink for the country, they'd be very busy. They'd get a lot of money out of us.
Yeah. But they'd also be crazy.
Yeah, but we need... Like, I think therapy should be compulsory for everyone in South Africa. Everyone. The government, instead of spending money on all the other stuff, everyone in South Africa should go and spend an hour once a week. It's not a lot. I know people who go to therapy 3 times a week. 1 hour every week, everyone in South Africa goes to a shrink and they just sit you down and you just tell them your problems and purge some of that anger and everybody sorts their shit out and you get up feeling better and get out.
Isn't it going to become circular because the therapists are going to need therapy ultimately? And then
but we'll worry about that when we get to it.
Chose your profession, now deal.
First do your job to fix us and then deal.
But where do we even begin with our problems?
So Nicholas, tell me how you got into all of this and where you're at the moment, because I do remember when you were in here the last time. We asked a whole bunch of questions, and you guys, it was mostly about like you and who else was with you here then? Quentin and
Jason and Donovan.
Was it Jason?
Yes.
Yeah, it was.
It was Jason.
With another, there was another Oak here as well who wasn't a Goliath.
I can't remember. Anyway, it's a long time ago.
Probably the driver.
Tell us your story.
So my story is I started comedy 3rd of July 2011. Jason and I got on stage for the first time together. And before that, I was a call center agent for 9 years.
That's right. That's what I remember. That's what we spoke about. And I said to you, you know, that's got to be really shit. And you said no, because you actually have to be a master to get through to people, because people hate call centers.
Like, it's the most hated people.
Yeah.
Because even me, I've been in the call center, I understand, but when I see a private number or I answer the phone and somebody says, "Hi, Mr. Goliath, it's calling from wherever, do you have 2 minutes? I lose my damn mind. Like, I immediately switch off and I don't want to speak to them.
But I remember you saying that if you can do it, if you actually manage to get through to one or two people a day, you feel like the king of the world.
No, it's the most
because
amazing.
They're not rude to you. And you actually are having a conversation, because most of the time, all they want to do is get away from you.
Yeah. And the thing is, so for me, I worked in sales call centers. So I was a short-term insurance salesman, which is, it's a grudge purchase. Every time you hear from insurance, it's a negative thing. So yeah, when you're able to get through to someone and give them something that they actually need, that in all essence is going to benefit their life if something should go wrong, it's a wonderful thing. And the money is not terrible. Like, I was having a conversation with a couple of guys about a week ago. And I was saying, you know, the problem with call center is you get stuck. You get trapped in the call center. And they couldn't understand. They're like, what do you mean? And people assume for some reason that if you work in a call center, you're making no money. When I started in the call center in 2003, it was my second job in a office job. I was doing like promotional work.
What, are you all kind of sitting in cubicles? How does it work?
No, it's open plan. You've got the partitions up just to separate the desk so that there's no noise
transfer.
Do you
use a headset?
Headset, exactly like this, with a mouthpiece, and you're just there because you need both your hands free so you can type and email and do all the things. But I mean, so coming into the call center, I came from doing promotional work and that type of thing. Where I was earning 2-3 grand a month, if that much, into the call center where my first paycheck was 15 grand.
It's a hell of an upgrade.
Yeah, and that was doing the bare minimum. Where guys that were pushing really hard were making 40-50 grand a month.
Do you get paid on commission?
Commission, yeah. So your basic's like 3 grand a month.
I think that's like the university of sales, actually.
Yeah.
If you think about it, because once you can do that, you can do anything in sales. That's the most difficult place to sell.
Yeah. No, it's insane. Call center, because also there's no, like, you have literally 10 seconds of the call to entice the person to listen to what you have to say. After 10 seconds, they've switched off. They've decided whether or not they want to speak to you.
So how do you even... Have you got liners? Is there stuff that you come up with? Because you're a funny guy, so it must have been easier for you than it would be for some, you know, some dude who's never ever done this before.
So,
or someone who's just boring.
Yeah, well, the thing is, in the financial industry, most call centers have a script, and you have to stick to script because of FICA and FAS and all of the things. So you've got to stick to the script. So it's all just
I'm sorry, I was just about to fall asleep when you started calling that FICA.
That's actually why I left.
I nodded off.
Once they said, you've got to go through all of this fit and proper and all of these training things, then I was like, no, guys, this is not for me. I've done my 12 years at school. I just wasn't interested in finance at all, except my own personal.
So you had a script or you made up your own?
No, there was a script. From the introduction, from the way they say, good morning, Mr. Cliff, you're speaking to Nicholas, calling you from the insurance. All of that scripted.
Try it with me.
Oh.
Let's go.
Okay.
Hi,
good day. Am I speaking with Mr. Gareth Cliff?
No, I don't have time. I'm sorry. I can't take your call now.
You see? And that's where the problems come.
I thought you had a way out of that.
That's where the problems come in, because then they're like, no, call
Shame.
Center.
And you know, these people are just trying to earn a living, and they're trying to do a job. Oh, and we hate them.
And you have to understand the stress that they are under. Sales call centers, those people are pushing you because they are being pushed. Like management, they don't care.
Do they walk around and like, how many have you got today? And
yeah.
Every day.
I've worked in call centers where you don't leave till you've made 3 sales. Doesn't matter where you started, what time of day it is. I was calling people 8 o'clock at night while people are sitting and having dinner. Now I'm trying to sell you insurance after you've just had a long cuck day and heard about gross paintings in the world. Now you must buy insurance. People are like,
We hate them until the day when we need to talk to an agent because some idiot rammed into your car and now you've got to make a claim or you want to bitch and moan about your network.
Then you hate them even more. Because now you're angry. Now it's their fault. They didn't. All they did was make their cup of tea when they came into the office in the morning. Now they're getting sworn at because some taxi driver cut in front of you and you moored into the barrier. No.
Hannes, what's the cuckest job you've ever had?
It's probably for CakeNet.
What did you do for them? It was so cuck.
No. The truth is, I suppose I've been fortunate that since I studied drama and kind of moved into the entertainment industry right off the bat, but I used to do like children's theater stuff, which was really insane as well, because you do like, I think with one tour of a show, we did 81 shows in 6 weeks where you're traveling through the whole country. And then you're taking like a show that's, it's kind of basis is white middle class. It's about divorce. And then you're doing a show in Butterworth where there's just no real grasp of those.
Divorce is not their biggest problem in Butterworth.
Yes, there's more issues at hand.
And you're dressing up in stupid outfits and talking in funny voices.
Yeah.
So how do you
talk? That was the most thankless.
How do you talk to children?
Well,
carefully.
Hello.
Slowly. Yeah.
Slowly.
Did you ever meet any real shithead kids who like tried to kick you?
Yeah, get thrown
the balls
with stuff.
And, really?
Yeah, that wax. You know, that wax paper. You know, from the Samis. You know, with bits of sandwich spread. You know,
and they hated you.
Yeah. But I mean, there's X amount of bad nights that you have as a comic, or you know, I once did a show. This was randomly with like a sketch troupe I was in, where we it happened to be Miller's South Africa's launch in Mpumalanga, where we start. They're all actually there to see the Springbok Nude Girls, and then we start this little sketch thing where I do this bit in my underpants, and I got thrown by bottles and yeah,
drunk people, right?
Girls pointing at my tutti, going ha 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 ha. It, yeah, it's those kind of those are the worst.
Why was
jobs.
Your tutti exposed? Can you talk
well, I was
about
in underpants. It? Was a, I was doing like a bodybuilding sketch. Okay. Yeah, okay. It was that yes. funny at the time.
All right, now Nicholas, what happens when you get heckled? Because I brought this up with one of the other comics the other day, and there are different ways of dealing with this. Some people are very good at kind of knocking it back, and sometimes it gets playful, but sometimes these hecklers can actually, they can mess up a show. Like, and it doesn't happen as much in South Africa as it might happen in other places, but when it does, it can sometimes throw you, and then it just spoils everything, and everyone has a cuck night because of it.
Yeah, well, look, it depends. Like, there's different types of comedians. There are guys who, for me personally, I love going into the audience. I love waiting for a heckler, because now you've given me a license to destroy you in every sense of the word. I can talk about the way you look. I can find out information. Who are you? Where do you come from? What type of work do you do? That's why your life sucks, because look at the shit person that you are in this world. And now you're here trying to come and ruin a show for people that have worked hard. They've spent good money to come and be entertained. And you are here. You think that you're better than everybody else. Now you're coming and fucking up the show with your own shit jokes, foot sack. I'm like, we can easily put you out. Because then the thing is, if the great thing about that is, if you do it properly, you get the whole room yes. to turn on that one heckler. If you can handle that, you get if a you mob. Can make that happen. I did a gig with Joey Rustin last week out in Four Ways, and I was hosting, and one of the guys,
before you know it, they've made a cross and nailed it.
No, they're ready. Dude, I saw, so Joey Rustin is on stage, he's doing some stuff, there's an 18th birthday party at the venue, and they make 18-year-olds, you know, they are drunk, making a noise. So he's like, guys, can you see, this is the problem. It happened to be a full white table.
Yeah.
So he's like, yeah, can you see, this is the future of white South Africa. Can you see what we're dealing with here? But in the beginning, I explained, and I was like, everything comedians say on stage, we do it in the theme of entertainment. We have to entertain. We talk about the sensitive things because it's on everybody's mind.
It's all
mind.
Material.
Exactly. Mm. But it's non-offensive. We never want to directly offend you. If we do offend you, then you must be less sensitive. Just calm down and
Correct.
Carry on with your life.
You always have two options. You can always go, I'm offended. And then I don't know what you expect to happen after that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or you can say, eh.
He's not for me.
It's not for me, yeah. Move on.
So this guy, yeah, so what happened is this guy, one of the guys at the table, he was the chaperone, gets up, big, massive chum guy, can see he was in the mood. He's like, yo, do you want to take this outside?
Oh, what a douche.
Joey Rustin, my hero. He was like, my guy, what the hell do you think you're doing here? Do you see me? Me, I'm not going to fight you. I'm going to get this girl, this guy's girlfriend to move. Because there was a guy there with a chum girl also. Just like a fucking strong woman. He was like, I'm going to get her to move you. And then everybody else in this audience is going to move you as well. Then the whole audience was like, yeah, we will move you now.
That is mob mentality 101.
That is.
Like,
that
actually, footsack.
And that's something. That's Joey also sharing his experience. Because I love seeing young comics like did, because in South Africa also we don't have, like in the UK you'll get hecklers shouting out really clever replies and comments. Yeah, we just get, hey, I do this, you know, that's just
it's
kind of what you get.
Stupid.
And then it's always funny when you see like a comic just starting out dealing with his first heckler, and then they get angry, and then that ostracizes the audience. Whereas if you've got a bit of experience, you learn to become a little systematic. You'll kind of let the guy go the first time. The second time, you'll just say, simmer down. The next time, you go, fuck you. You know? So if you learn to do it systematically, it becomes like a little cat and mouse game where you wait until you know the audience is going to be on your side. And then the rest of your set's even better because now you've got them completely.
Have you ever made anyone cry?
Yeah, but that wasn't on stage. It was an ex.
Sex.
I'm sorry. She still hates me till today.
Oh, dear.
Look at me now.
No, I was broke. I was broke and no one ever in the world. Like,
She probably hates you extra because, you know, now she's like, and he went on to be successful. Mm. That girl.
And I'm married to the woman that I left her for.
Oh, nice.
My goodness.
Hold
Drops
your son.
My sons. I've got two. Eldest is 8 and my youngest is 3.
when you look at your kids, I mean, do you see yourself in them? Because I always, if I were to have a kid, the main reason, because it's kind of ego.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people, if you loved children and it wasn't about you, you'd adopt.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, but it's nice that it's your kid and you see things about yourself in that kid.
Yeah.
You see things that remind you of your parents in the kid.
Yeah. I find that I see more of myself in my youngest, Adam. He's more the antagonizer, loves teasing his brother. Like, he's just learned to speak and he's teasing people. He does things specifically. If he sees that it upsets you, then he's like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of the day, actually. Yeah, so, like, because that's how I got into comedy.
What were you like at school?
I was the class clown. I was the teacher's pet and the class clown. So, like, teachers loved me.
Versatile.
Yeah, like, they loved me to the point that even when I was doing shit, they were like, yeah, but you're such a nice kid.
Yeah, but Nicholas, it's because you've got to be, I've always said, you've got to be clever to be a comedian. You can't be a comedian, be doof.
No.
Anyone thinks they can tell a joke, and a joke is fine. You might be able to do that, possibly. But you can't get up on a stage. You're basically naked in front of a bunch of animals. And these people are going, come on, make me laugh. And sometimes your head's not in the right place.
Yeah.
You've got to have a fallback, and you've got to be smart. And I'm sure you were really clever at school, too. So that's why you were the teacher's pet. So you delivered on the results.
Well, yeah. So clever but lazy, to be very honest. That's been the story of my life.
No, that's extra clever. Because why? These people used to work themselves to death at school level. For what? So I always looked at these A students and the A plus students. And I always thought, why? Whether you get a 60 or a 95...
We're all going to the same university.
Yeah, and you know what? You might end up being, I don't know, admitted before me, but I'll get there eventually. And I'm cleverer than you because I'll apply myself where I need to, and I'll sleep the rest of the time.
But, I mean, sometimes, you know, some kids have all kinds of pressures put on them. You will go to medical school. You know, this is not the parents.
Yeah,
your
parents.
You
I
will
did,
do
actually.
This. We expect this from you. And, you know, sometimes that's the reason that these kids are pushing themselves as hard as they are.
Yeah, the thing for me is my parents were always about education. You had to be educated. So when I matriculated, my mother said to me, you're either going to work or you're going to study. And I didn't know fuck when I go and work. I just came out of 12 years of work. Yeah, I was like, exactly. No ways. Let me rather go and study. But I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I eventually, you know, you it's like a multiple choice. Now you're just selecting things off the application form.
Were you just like throwing darts at the thing and whatever it landed
just like,
on?
What
you'd
is
go
this corporate communication? That sounds good. That's what I always wanted to do. Corporate communication. Yeah. Then 6 months into my first year of corporate communication, I'd been to probably two lectures. For the year.
But you knew it was bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Corporate communication. What a waste of time.
I didn't even know. To be honest, I didn't even know at the time what corporate communication was.
And you were studying it.
I was just like, let's go and find out. Maybe it is something cool. So, yeah, that sort of forced me. My parents forced me into it. But I also understand, like, coming from where they come from, I speak about it often, like their focus, because they came up in apartheid, their focus for me was to educate me so that I could get away from apartheid. Because I feel like in the time, you couldn't see the end. There was no end to apartheid coming. Like, this is just my own personal thing. Like, if you were my parents' generation, you couldn't see the end. All you knew all your life was apartheid, so you couldn't see the end. So for your kids, you will always want better, so you educate them, try and get them away. Whereas like now, me with my kids, I just want my kids to be happy. I don't care if they are painters, welders, mechanics, whatever. It doesn't matter as long as you're happy.
What if your kid says to you, what if Adam, the youngest one, says to you he wants to be a comic?
Oh, man, that'll make me so happy.
Really?
So happy.
Because sometimes if you are in that line, if you're an entertainer, then... You might, because you know how hard it is too. You might not want your kid to have to struggle with that stuff. Plus, he's kind of then, again, this is all theoretical because you don't know what he wants to be at 4 years old. He doesn't even know. But if he does come to you one day, then you know you're the role model, right? And, and you know that he's going to try to be you.
Yeah.
And that can be tough. That's why a lot of these great musicians, when their kid says they want to be a musician, they're like, ah. Yeah. Can't you do this instead?
Here's a paintbrush.
I've got a 2.5-year-old girl.
Yeah.
It's funny, like when she plays with her cousins or, you know, toy microphone, it's like she's just a natural. And I recall we were traveling from a coastal holiday back, and we stayed at the Green Lantern Inn, you know, kind of halfway back. And she just started walking, and she kind of found her way onto a stage. And there was this moment where, and she looked so natural there, and she was dancing to the music. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. She's going to move into theater. And then I just looked at the surroundings and the fairy lights and the music playing and the wooded, you know, kind of background. And I was like, oh, fuck, she's going to become a stripper. So there's a moment where I go yes, and then I go but the hardships that go with entertainment, you know, I'm not sure if I want to wish that upon her. But
and what about what's your background?
I grew up in Roodepoort, as we
we'll pretend we didn't hear that. What else?
My mother was an English teacher, so a love for language, and she directed the school plays. So from a very young age, I was kind of running around that space. So I kind of got used to it from an early age. And so I was kind of a nerdy kid at school that took part in everything, although I was mediocre in most things, but pretty good in the kind of arts. So it kind of just followed me all the time.
There's a question about why people do this stuff. I mean, for you to go into like performing on stage at school level, is that because the applause feels good, or is it because you know you're good?
Sure. I think it starts out with liking the applause and the attention. I mean, then at some point, which leads to becoming a comic perhaps, is, you know, there was a fair amount of bullying for being that kind of nerdy kid. And then kind of when you're 16, and I was in Standard 8 in 1994, so you that's when you kind of develop a political kind of idea and conscience. And, you know, that time in my life when you just trying to find things and you see all this change in a country, but you're also getting bullied. So then you discover subversive material and rock music. So, I mean, I was that nerdy kid who listened to Marilyn Manson while I was doing my homework. But then something gets instilled in you to kind of kick against the pricks. And then only years later, after I studied drama and I wanted to be an actor, I started doing, and we had kind of sketch stuff, and Complex was a show on SBC.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then
that's probably where a lot of people would have first seen you.
Yes. And it was this cult kind of show that not people who liked it really loved it. People who didn't like it didn't watch it. So, it's, you know, it's one or the other.
Yeah,
and then I started doing improv and then discovering stand-up and going, wait a minute, here's finally a voice where I feel I can speak for myself and kind of try and be a little proactive, yet at the same time tell dick
jokes.
But
your apex predators of the performing arts are your comics.
I think so.
You guys are like sharks. You are killing machines.
Because it's a survival, not only to make a living, but also on the given night. If you've got a tough room, you wanna top them. You wanna slay them as opposed to
correct.
Die.
And it must be the best feeling. I can only imagine how good it feels when you win like that.
Yeah.
When you've got an audience that starts off and they're cold and cuck, and everybody else has told you, because there's usually a lineup, and the oak who went on before you comes on and says to you, yes, this crowd are tough.
Yeah.
Enjoy the flames. And then you go out and you win.
Yeah.
That's got to feel like heaven, right?
I think that's what Barack felt like when they announced, like, you are the president. I think that's that's the only way I can sort of say that's the feeling. Because there's nothing better. Like you say, when an audience, I've walked into so many rooms where I'm like, hey, this audience, we're about to die. We're about to see flames. But also, we never know. Like, we walk into a room that's 20 people and you think it's going to be cuck. And then you find you have the best time because it's so intimate, people are so close, and people comedy is just a beautiful thing.
And because you're up there alone as well, you're already kind of, there's a lot of adrenaline going already, and then when it starts hitting and the laughter, I always kind of compare it to, I don't know nothing about surfing, but it's kind of like you're on a wave that just keeps going, and the laughter is this wave that just pushes you on to kind of, you know, pick up the pace and, you know, hit harder.
Do you have a
when
lot
it
of,
fails, it's a fuck up.
Do you have a lot of other comics as friends, or do you have ordinary civilians as friends? I know, I mean, with you it's got to be tough too, because, you know, the Goliaths is kind of an institution, and it's one of those institutions in South African comedy which has grown incredibly fast and due to a lot of hard work, and you guys are considered like the most successful name in comedy.
Oh yeah, Mr. Destiny Man cover star.
Look at you.
Yes, yeah, I am in the flesh. You can come and take pictures. If you close by, I'm here. I'll be here till 11. Yeah, man. You know, it is a tough thing. But I've got the comedy industry in our country is still so new that there's a handful of comedians, man. It's like I was having a discussion with somebody last night and saying, in the country, in the whole of South Africa, I think there's probably 1,000 comedians that are worth their weight in gold. Like, and if 1,000 is a stretch. I feel like it's a hell of a stretch. But if you compare it to any other industry, anything, there's millions of people in every other industry. Whereas there's 1,000 comedians, you know. So it's there's no time for.
Do you ever wonder where you fit into the pecking order?
All the time.
Because like in radio, I was always just super obsessed, competitive, worrying about whether I was the best guy that week. When the ratings came out, I would immediately look at all the other douchebags and check whether I'd beaten them. I hated them on a personal level. I never said it to them. I was always polite. But deep down, because I think I've matured a little bit. I've outgrown a lot of that stupidity. But, I mean, Mubs remembers in the beginning, I saw this as war, and I hated the other guys who did morning radio. If I wasn't the top guy, I was depressed.
Yeah, but that's because radio, you directly in competition with those guys.
No.
Like, if they're like either listening to you or they're listening to the other whack guy.
It's not like that in comedy.
No, comedy, because the thing is, if you watch me today and you love what I do, you love comedy. You don't want to see me again next week. So next week you want to go and see Hannes to see what Hannes is doing. So whatever I do creates work for Hannes, and whatever Hannes does creates work for me. So, and because our industry is so small, there's enough audience. There's what, 50 million people in our country and fucking 1,000 comedians, guys. Oh. There's enough. We can each have what? I don't, my math is not
correct.
I'll take 5,000. Thank you.
I think there's a slightly competitive kind of nature to it, but it's not a vindictive one.
Yes.
On a given night, if Nick is dying, then I'm worried, okay, then I'm going to struggle as well. If he's winning, it makes it a little bit easier for me as well. It's not like, oh, damn it, he's taking my, you know. So on a given night at a gig, you're kind of going, we're working together. And it is a quite close-knit community.
Yeah.
We don't braai at each other's house every day. But
like you all
but
know
there's
each
also
other,
an
right?
element. Yeah, yeah. When I see them on Destiny magazine, I'm going, fuck, I can't even make the Roy Rosa, you know.
Don't beat yourself up about it. It's a healthy competition.
Right?
But now tell me, the venue often, because people, you know, we always talk about the crowd and then we talk about the comic, but there's some venues that are just fantastic for comedy. Mm. And there's some places that are just terrible. They're dodgy. Sound is bad. They watered down the drinks at the bar. There's an owner who always wants to pay you in cash and never has enough. Yeah, there's some venues that you just don't want to play at. I mean, without mentioning names, describe the cuckest place you've had to do your thing.
They show up more often than you think.
Yeah,
because it's always some guy who has a bar and he's thinking of bringing some live entertainment in.
The idea.
Yeah, and yes. Tuesdays are really quiet. Don't you oaks want to do a comedy thing?
And I'm like,
so we're getting
quiet.
The quiet night. But yeah, it's those beer-stained kind of rooms. There's a few.
I'm going to name the place. It was Baba J's.
Baba J's. Yeah, I was about to say Baba J's.
Baba J's, guys.
Yes. Baba J's.
No, Baba J's. Baba J's.
Where is this?
I saw it. It's the east, right?
Yeah,
I'm going to name Boxburg, it's like exactly the opposite end from Krugersdorp. It's like
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's
polar
like,
opposite, but identical in racism terms.
Yeah,
okay.
Identical. I saw a bottle of an empty Black Label bottle fly across the room at a comedian at Baba J's.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even racist. He was just black. I was like, shame. And from Zim also. So it's horrible.
And
the audiences were horrible. The room was wonderful.
What did they look like, these people who go there?
I once did a gig there.
That's exactly where they came from. I think that's where they shot The Hills Have Eyes, actually.
it was towards the death of comedy at Baba J's. And that's the other thing. There's always only like 8 people and the barman.
Doesn't exist anymore,
so
right?
I think the venue still exists, but they don't do comedy. But I once went on and I was hosting. And as I went on, it was a table of, like, I think they were Eskom technicians or something. And this guy, as I walked on, he was just shouting, Brakpan, Brakpan, Brakpan. I don't know what. So
he was proud
thing,
to be from there, obviously. You know, yeah. It's a thing for him.
So the first thing I said was like, oh, look, a guy from Brakpan with only 10 fingers. To which he replied, sorry, bro, I've only got 8. And then he had like, 2 amputated fingers.
He
like,
thought he had a great comeback.
Back, yeah. And then I asked him, what's your name? And I, for radio, it's perhaps too visual. What's your name? And he went, Spider-Man.
Oh, my God.
And that's the kind of stuff you had to deal with. Yeah. Oh. Well, that guy won that round, obviously. But yeah. That's the kind of audience members.
You see, and now you are using that story to get laughs. I mean, yeah. What a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I actually kind of want to experience Baba J's now.
No. See, but those rough
Take
rooms.
Take Garrett with you.
Those really rough rooms are where you learn the most. I can't.
But guys, do you ever get, because a lot of comics in this world of social media now, they worry about being quoted out of context. There's some idiot with a cell phone filming you. You know, you could be telling the best joke ever, and in the wrong context, someone could think that you're the biggest douchebag, racist, sexist, misogynist, homophobe. You pick your problem. Mm. And it could, these days, that kind of thing can actually ruin a career.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you ever worry about that? Because when you're on the stage, you've got to feel free. You've got to know that you, the audience, and you're in sync with them, and there's a thing happening. The last thing you want to do is self-censor at that point, right?
Yeah. And you never know when that out-of-context statement is going to... I sometimes, because the reality of who I am, where I come from, is I'm a white Afrikaans speaking male. So,
the white,
potential for scrutiny, you know, yeah, is exactly. Kind of there. Yeah. I mean, the last thing I'm,
but
I don't
no
want
one gets away.
Someone
with
to misunderstand me and think, oh, yes, you know, he's aligned with this kind of way of thinking. Yeah. Or, you know,
that's every Afrikaans so white guy's yeah, worst yes, fear yeah. Is that everyone thinks he is. He's, yeah. This monstrous racist that yeah. He's frightened.
Starts calling
me
Steve or something. Yeah. So well, so you think about it, but then also when you walk up, you go, well, hopefully I've got other material or a good enough, you know, audience that understands who I really am that they won't concern themselves with it.
Yeah, so. I think my feeling's pretty much the same. Like I don't want to self-censor myself. So I get up and I say what I say. On stage, and because people have often asked me, like, where do you draw the line in comedy? And for me, there's no line. It all depends on your delivery. That's where the line should be. Like, you can say anything, you can talk about any situation, subject. If you deliver it properly and with the right mindset, your audience is going to love it. And if you get the audience on your side, they're not going to want to put you in that situation. You know, there's like that connection. Like you were saying, you know, you're on stage, you're basically naked telling your stories. So once we've had that connection, you're going to be a big asshole to be the one saying, taking a clip of my amazing set and putting up a specific piece that portrays me.
But it does happen. I mean, we've seen this happen. Like, Chris Rock says he doesn't want to play at certain places anymore because there's so many activist like students at universities, for example. He won't do them. He said if he goes there, he just feels like if he's not politically correct, he's out. And if he doesn't have certain, you know, it's a problem in this country too, like ideology. Mm. Some people really think that's important. Like they're so obsessed with their identity that is all they think about. And anytime anyone says anything about it that doesn't agree with them, they're hugely personally offended. I mean, I do 3 hours a day, 5 days a week here. It amounts to, I don't know, tens of thousands of hours that I've been doing shows. All I hear when people who don't know I'm listening are talking about me is how shocking and outrageous and controversial I am. 99% of everything I say is probably middle of the road.
Mm. Yeah.
But that's the reputation.
Yeah.
Does that worry you? When you're in comedy, that could be good or bad.
Somehow on stage, I feel it's a safer environment because there's also, you know, even though most comics, your stage persona is just an extension of yourself. It's kind of the guy that would say things that you wouldn't say in polite company. So I'm less worried about that. It's almost now that you see this kind of social network kind of environment where it's almost you pick the battles. You know, I do not want to get involved with this argument because inevitably it's easy for someone to say, no, but that was a stupid statement, or every now and again you do enjoy it and you go, yeah, okay, I'm gonna fuck these people up.
Also,
but you know, but there's a slight awareness in that space, more so on stage. I don't worry about it too much.
Yeah, but I also feel like on stage is different to radio, because radio, you know, they're hearing your voice and they've got their own picture. Most times people don't even know what the radio DJ sounds like or looks like.
Well, thanks,
you know?
They're lucky.
Yeah, like the DJ Ankle Tap, for years I thought he was a black guy, and I saw him, I couldn't fucking believe it. And now he's a good friend of mine. But, you know, the thing is, so I feel like that personal connection, once we're in a space, I feel like it's a completely different thing. So I hear what you're saying, but I also feel like just the way people are receiving the message is different, like the setup, because with comedy we do a whole setup and we let people know this is what's going to be happening, we're going to be talking about these things, calm down, understand. And people that are in the room have paid, they've come to see comedy, that they know what it's about. So it's generally, I think, like you run the biggest risk maybe with like your first time audience members, or you know, people that are there with a corporate who don't like comedy.
I actually wanted to ask you, I mean, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you about these corporate ones, because with your sales background too, and something like emceeing is very different to doing a stand-up routine.
Yeah.
And you can do both, which is actually a really tough thing to be able to do, because you're almost switching on one part of your brain and switching off another one.
Yeah. Well, technically not switching off. So the MC thing is more, it's more formal, you know, it's structured, that type of thing. But the comedy, I feel like the comedy never switches off. It's always just lurking in the background. So that, and that's what I say, you know, like a lot of companies are now using comedians as MCs simply because things go wrong at events. Every single event I've done, something's gone wrong. Then you want to have somebody on stage that's not going to say, we've got a technical problem, we'll be back in 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
What cuck is that? What are you doing? They're paying the you time. Money, and now you're fucking off the stage as soon as something goes wrong.
And make people, keep them watching you, keep them focused.
Yeah, so your job becomes to facilitate something rather than be the
funniest guy in the
room.
You've got to keep the energy up, you've got to be entertaining, you've got to be lighthearted, and you've got to be lovable. Everybody in the room has got to like you.
So what are we plugging at the moment? What are you guys doing in the next few days, if people might be interested in coming?
Goliath,
hit us.
Experience 2017.
Tell
me about Goliath Comedy Club, turning 1 year
How
old.
How is that place doing?
Yay.
It's amazing.
I'm so proud of you guys for doing that.
Thank you.
I mean, it's like, it's such,
oh my gosh,
the boom.
It is such a ballsy move.
Guys, give me a small erection now.
Just a small
wasn't
one.
Wasn't exactly the reaction.
Mabali, this is a real step backwards for you. Only a small erection.
That's okay. I don't want his wife to mess with any of us.
Yeah. She's colored and Muslim.
Your kids Muslim?
No, my kids are technically religion free at the moment.
How wonderful.
They'll decide.
How wonderful.
I was forced to go to church my whole life, and then I'm like, I married a Muslim woman. Yeah, you know.
I love that. Like,
they'll decide.
To you guys, it's just such a non-issue.
Yeah, we're happy.
And if the kids decide would they want to be Muslims or Christians at age 18, lekker.
They can be Hindu for all I care.
Yeah.
As long as you are happy and you understand your thing, that's it. Right. Anyway, back to it. So the festival, our club's turning a year old. We're doing a week-long festival. It starts on Monday the 24th and runs till the 29th. We've got six nights, six different shows from new school, old school. We've got headliners. We've got a 13-5. www.goliathcomedyclub.com. Book your tickets now. That's
magic, bro. And listen, amazing. That place is, it's just, even if you only go for the comedy, you'll be surprised at how much extra you get. If you're going for all the other things, you'll never be disappointed either. It's just
Thank
awesome.
You.
Yeah, I've been
when
once.
When are you going to come and do a five? I feel like you could.
Are you kidding?
I feel like you need to just have that space just to vent and be.
Never would I do stand. Not a chance. I know that I'd be terrible.
Okay.
And you know what? I don't play golf because I'm terrible. I don't partake in any. I'm not a team player. I don't enjoy myself if I'm not winning. If I go on and I know that the guy who's going on before me is a professional and the guy who's going after me is a professional, you're not going to push me on that stage with a crowbar.
Okay.
But you had an appearance on Generations the 1 year. And I mean, you're not an actor.
Please.
That's why I was on Generations.
Neither are any of the people in Generations. All right. Listen, everybody.
Can I do my plugs?
Yeah.
I'm currently in rehearsals for Afrikaans pantomime called Doringrosi. That's yeah.
Where is that?
The Sleeping Beauty. It's at Emperor's from the 5th of May until the 4th.
What's your role?
I'm one of the good fairies. Yes. I'm one of the dames. Yes.
It sounds like it's going to be packed full of people from Krugersdorp.
And then a show that we just did at Cock
and Car. Empress is too far, though.
That we can all look forward to is myself, Skull Poseidon, and Casper de Vries doing three in one, which is
combo.
We just did it at Cock and Car, and we're looking at many more dates to come.
So how was Cock and Car?
It was great. It was a little pretentious, and people argue about, you know, silly things, and then Dion Maas writes an article, and for the rest of the week that's all people can talk about. You know, so it's always looking for some kind of controversy, but to the best of my understanding, people were actually going to the theater and not just sitting in the beer tent, so that's a positive. I had a great time, and I was there with really cool people. So,
well, listen, it sounds like you both are as busy as hell, and that's excellent, and I wish you all the best of luck for the rest of 2017. And please just keep doing what you're doing. You know, I still think that the talent that we've got in comedy in this country is extraordinary. Even if there are only 1,000,
it's the best in the world.
I think so.
I say it every time we get on stage. It's the best.
It's like a crucible of just incredible people in an incredible environment who have so much input and output that it's really a privilege to be able to do this kind of
and
show.
And a lot of honesty. I think our comics are honest.
Yeah, and it's our first time that we get to tell our stories on a stage. Like, I think we've got amazing stories to tell. We've heard all the first world stories. Oh, my iPad broke for time.
All right, let's wrap it up. Here's the unnews for this morning. Thank you to our guests, to Nicholas Goliath and to Hannes Brummer.
Thank you.
Thank you. CliffCentral.com.